welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today we have Dr. Arnold Baskies. He is a clinical professor of surgery, Rowan School of Medicine, also chairman of the American Cancer Society Global Cancer Control Advisory Council, and past chair of the American Cancer Society National Board. I'm not worthy. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that great introduction. You know, what they say is behind every great man is an amazed mother-in-law. So,
well, the American Cancer Society is a frequent guest on this show, but I have to say that, wow, we've really hit the jackpot today. But these are unusual times, obviously, and I'd like to start off with just asking, how has this pandemic affected the American Cancer Society?
Well, it's affected us in many ways, just as it has affected people in society. It's affected not only people in our entire society, but everyone in the American Cancer Society, from our volunteers to our staff people. And we have a very strong staff volunteer relationship that's been built over 100 years. This has obviously put a kink in those relationships. And it's forced us, as you know, to self-quarantine, to socially distance, and to take extraordinary measures in order to try to protect our most vulnerable people, the patient with cancer. So our focus remains that, but we've had to make a number of alterations in our schedule. For instance, all of our fundraisers that involve peer-to-peer events, galas, et cetera, that help us raise the hundreds of millions of dollars that are needed for cancer research and for our mission, all of those things have been postponed till following in the year, to later in the year, with the hope being that we'll be able to make those events happen the way they have. From a patient point of view, it obviously means a lot to us that we aren't able to do the things person to person that we were able to do before. We provide transportation, among other things. We provide transportation for patients so they can get to their doctor's offices, to their treatments, to the hospital, to physicians' offices, et cetera. We also provide housing in over 30 locations around the country, to the tune of millions of dollars that people would be spending if they, for instance, needed a bone marrow transplant, or they have to travel to a facility in Philadelphia, for instance, that provides tertiary care that they can't get in their own community. So we've had to, unfortunately, find alternative housing for those people that we would normally house in one of our Hope Lodges, for instance, in Philadelphia. However, the aspect of care hasn't changed. We still want to provide care and the necessary conveniences for patients. So what we've done is, because we've not been able to house the people in Hope Lodge because of social distancing, et cetera, we have opened our Hope Lodges, which provide free housing for patients, to first responders and to people like nurses and physicians who have to be at the hospital where the Hope Lodge is maintained. So we've had to make those changes, and when this epidemic is over, we can then start to rehouse our patients. But remember, the people that are most vulnerable in this particular event, the COVID-19 epidemic, are patients like people that have cancer, people that are undergoing chemotherapy, people that have had recent surgery. We can't forget those people. So the providers who are giving that care, that are now staying at Hope Lodge, are providing the care to the patient who would be staying at Hope Lodge. So we feel good about that we're making those adjustments in our everyday lives as American Cancer Society volunteers. And so this has made a number of changes in terms of our fundraising ability at this point in time. And we hope that people will remember that although we lost close to 30,000 people from COVID, which is an astronomical number, over that same period of time since January, we've lost 250,000 people from cancer. Cancer will remain with us after COVID has gone away. So this problem that we have right now is hopefully temporary, something that we'll adjust to, and hopefully by the end of the year, we'll be able to raise the kind of funds that we were raising in the past. We, right now, the American Cancer Society is the number one provider of cancer research dollars in the United States, secondary only to the federal government. We are supporting right now over $400 million worth of cancer research in all 50 states of this country. So it's incredibly important that we remember that we have to fight COVID, but we also have to fight cancer.
I do want to ask you about COVID-19 as we go into this conversation, but let's back it up just a little bit, though, because you mentioned cancer patients being the most vulnerable, and everybody knows there are certain precautions we all have to be taking at this time to protect ourselves and our loved ones, washing the hands, the face, the coughing, et cetera. We all have that drilled into us, but are there special precautions that someone who is facing cancer has to take right now? How is this directly affecting them? Because we're also looking at, you alluded to treatment and the Hope Lodges not being available right now. They're looking at delays in treatment and diagnosis, and you can't really wait a lot of times when you're facing cancer.
All of that is true. And luckily, our partners in this whole effort, the hospitals, the physicians, the major medical societies that deal with cancer patients, are all on the same page, like the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the Society of Surgical Oncology, for example. So to answer the first part of your question, patients with cancer are clearly very vulnerable because they are immunosuppressed oftentimes, especially if they're getting chemotherapy or have had recent surgery. So those people need to take the same precautions that we would take if we didn't have those issues at hand, i.e. social distancing, being extremely careful in terms of washing your hands and drying them, making sure that your countertops are clean, making sure that high touch areas of your home, such as light switches, the toilet flusher, the things that you normally, the door handles, all of those things are super clean in your household. When and if it's possible to delay a treatment, that has to be an individualized decision between the physician and the patient. So we can't give a recommendation with a broad brush. That has to be individualized. But in many instances, even before COVID, we've been able to delay treatments. For instance, if a patient developed an infection or appendicitis, or had, let's say, some viral infection that wasn't COVID, then under those circumstances, yes, chemotherapy is delayed, and with very little in the way of any negativity from having that delay. So it's very understandable that people can have their regimen possibly modified because of COVID, but nevertheless, it isn't the end of the world. And so, physicians are attacking this in different ways. I just got off a webinar a few minutes ago, actually, that discussed what hospitals and what physicians are doing, and there's been a lot of innovation. For instance, testing can sometimes be delayed. Certainly, if it's a diagnostic test, a delay of a few weeks oftentimes won't make any difference. So there's a risk-benefit ratio that has to be weighed on an individual basis. Is the risk of having a procedure done or is the risk of receiving your chemotherapy at this point in time higher than the benefit that you would derive if you got it? And in those instances where the risk-benefit ratio is either in favor or not in favor of proceeding with a treatment, then a decision can be made, but it has to be individualized. Telemedicine has been very helpful in many instances. When patients have a question, now they can actually get in touch with their physician and have a face-to-face communication as opposed to just a telephone call. So that innovation has been very helpful. But clearly, the risk-benefit ratio of proceeding with a treatment or a procedure has to be taken on an individual basis. Now, physicians have also modified the way they operate. Oftentimes, for instance, instead of walking into the office, having five or six people sitting there at one time, there'll be a specific time when a patient is told to come in that allows adequate time to wipe down the counters, make sure everyone's hands are clean, put on masks, et cetera, when necessary. So there isn't a lot of downtime in between the treatment and waiting in a waiting room. Sometimes even physicians will tell a patient, wait in your car until we know that the office is clear and clean and ready for you to come in. So there are all kinds of modifications that are made that are increasing, let's say, the safety or lessening the risk of a COVID infection just from going to the physician's office. So those changes have been made. Hospitals have made a lot of the adjustments that need to be made in order to decrease the risk. So all of those things need to be taken into consideration.
And of course, I'm going to assume that the American Cancer Society is always at the forefront of informing peers and patients, et cetera, about practice and what to do.
That is all true. And we've been trying to work as closely as we can with our sister societies that I mentioned already, for instance, the American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer, which we have a very warm relationship with. So all of these organizations are working in conjunction with one another to try to provide the information and the safety that is needed at this particular point in time. In addition to that, since you brought it up, let me talk to you a little bit about the National Call-In Center. So we have championed this particular aspect of care. Patients oftentimes need navigation and information, especially at a time like this when people's anxiety levels are at an all-time high for a whole bunch of reasons. Imagine having cancer now and having all of this COVID activity going on around you and wondering what you should do, what your next step should be. We have a call-in center that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The phone number is 1-800-227-2345. People can call at any time of the day and night. And we found that people get especially scared in the middle of the night, not knowing what to do or who to call or what to do or how to proceed. And we have people that are on those calls all the time. So that call-in center has been extremely helpful, even in times before we had this epidemic, but especially now, it's incredibly important.
I was going to give you a chance to blow your own horn and talk about these wonderful services, and that was the first thing that I was going to bring up. But when you go to cancer.org, you find the most amazing resources there. Everything from cancer A to Z, where you can look up terminology and find out information, to, again, that 24-hour hotline, 800-227-2345, and get that direct service from the society. And that's just some of the stuff that you do. And in just a moment, we're going to go into it because I really want to talk about the American Cancer Society again. But first, I want to say that website is cancer.org. You can also call that hotline. We just gave that. But for more information about anything that we talk about, you always go to cancer.org first, and that will direct you to your local chapter as well and to the services that are particular to your area. And again, you'll find information about anything and everything that is cancer. And today we are talking to the past chair of the American Cancer Society National Board. He is a clinical professor of surgery at Rowan School of Medicine, and chairman of the American Cancer Society's Global Cancer Control Advisory Council, Dr. Arnold Baskies. And again, cancer.org, the place to go for more information about what we talk about today. That's just one of the direct services that you offer. You mentioned the transportation that you provide as well, where volunteers will sign up to help get patients to and from treatment and appointments. You have the Hope Lodges, but you're also there with your work with peers and research. And that is so important. And I mentioned this before the show began. I asked because one of the things that I've always heard from the American Cancer Society is that those dollars are going to that spark, the special new research, the innovations that are going to lead to the great breakthroughs that the American Cancer Society has been, you know, just seminal in funding all along.
All of that is very, very true. And I'm glad that you emphasized it. Let me give you some information that many people aren't aware of. So one of the things that we recognized decades ago is that young investigators oftentimes provide the seed, the innovation that's needed to make the difference. And to that end, we have our concentration is on funding the best and the brightest and the newest ideas. So along those lines, we currently are funding, as I mentioned earlier, over $400 million worth of cancer research in the United States. We have funded 49 Nobel Prize winners before anyone ever heard of the name or what work they were doing. We have a very extensive grants process. We bring in the best and the brightest experts in the world to sit on a panel to discuss projects and grants that have been proposed, ideas that have been put forward, in order to try to discern which of those ideas are potential breakthroughs. And that has paid tremendous dividends to the tune of the fact that almost every single major cancer advance that's been made in the last 20 to 30 years has been supported by the American Cancer Society. We are not for profit, but we are also not part of the federal government. We are a volunteer-led organization whose goal is mission is to save lives, to celebrate lives, and to be a leader in the fight against cancer worldwide. And we've been extremely successful with that, and we want to make sure that we continue in that way.
Now, you are an oncology surgeon, but you were part of one of the first trials in immunotherapy as well. So do you want to talk a little bit about how the American Cancer Society has invested or done research in immunotherapy? Because that, of course, crosses all lines of medicine at this point. This is not just pertaining to cancer. Your research has ramifications for everyone and almost every disease and every ailment.
So you brought up an interesting topic, which is near and dear to my heart, which is immunotherapy. So in the 1970s, I did my fellowship at the National Cancer Institute with Steve Rosenberg, who is considered to be the father of immunotherapy, adoptive immunotherapy. And I participated in literally the very first positive immunotherapy trial in the world, giving patients an immune adjuvant, and we were able to show that we were able to boost their immune system, and it made a difference in survival. Since that time, there have been many, many advances that have really dissected the immune structure of the human body. The thing that made the biggest difference in terms of where we are today is the Human Genome Project, which was funded by the federal government in the 1990s. And everything that we know about immunotherapy is based on the work that was seminal in the 1970s, and then finally with the Human Genome Project in the 1990s. And so you're exactly right. When we look at the advances in cancer, we're looking at people that, for instance, have some forms of lung cancer that it was metastatic and are now alive 4, 5, 6 years later. That was unheard of before these advances in immunotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors. We're looking at patients who have melanoma, for instance, that's metastatic, and using dual drug therapy based on immunotherapy are alive and well. The most famous of those people, if you will, is Jimmy Carter, who had a brain metastasis from melanoma and other metastases. In other words, the melanoma had spread and is alive and well and free of disease at this time. This was unheard of until the last few years. And there are new drugs coming out all the time that are aimed at stopping cancers from growing based on the immunology of those cancers. So the changes that are occurring are now almost everyday events. And thank goodness that we have the ability to alter the immune system to the benefit of those patients.
Now, would you like to explain in really simple immunotherapy for dummies? Because you mentioned drugs and then genes. Are we looking at the person's genes, or are we looking at the disease's genes?
Actually, both. And you're highlighting something that's kind of interesting at this point in time. The attack on COVID is a good example of lessons we've learned in cancer that are now being extended to COVID. So you're exactly right. We know now that it appears that there might be genetic changes that account for why some people are getting extremely sick with COVID and why others are not. And the same thing applies in the world of cancer, interestingly enough. We can identify the risk of a woman, for instance, with breast cancer in many instances, having a relapse based on the genetics of that particular cancer. All we need is a little sample of the tumor, and we can look at that tumor now in many instances and be able to predict A, whether there'll be a relapse within 5 years. And also it can tell us what treatment would be best for that patient. We have commercially available tests for that. So there is actually a lot of similarities in some of the ways that COVID is being attacked from a pharmaceutical point of view. Right now, there are over 250 studies looking at treatments for COVID. Many of them are genetically based, and many of them are based on lessons we've learned how cancers are treated.
Now, going back to my question then, we have the genetics of its victims, the people that are being attacked by a COVID or by a cancer. I think we've all heard of the BRCA gene. That's part of our vernacular now, the layman's vernacular. But then when we're looking at COVID and certain cancers, why are some so successful? Why do these things survive to cross the ocean and to move into this pandemic state while others before it, like SARS, did not?
That's the $64,000 question, as they used to say. The question you're asking belies a lot of science. We know that this virus, the COVID virus, actually is a bat virus that has made it into humans. It's cross species. So was SARS and so was MERS. MERS, SARS, and COVID, or SARS-2, as it's in a more formalized name for it. All three of those are coronavirus beta. They belong into a family that share a number of genetic similarities. The reason that some people get sicker with COVID than others is probably, it may well be related to that person's ability to react to it. It could be that simple. But what is it that triggers that immune reaction to the extent where a person overreacts to it? We know that many patients who succumb to COVID or have a severe reaction to it are actually having almost a hyperimmune response to it, what we call cytokine release, which, by the way, is very similar to the problem that occurs in patients who are getting T cell therapy. So there are some similarities. I don't want to make it sound like they're one and the same, but there are a number of similarities to the way we look at this disease process. And a lot of it is based on our knowledge of how we respond to cancers. So those reactions that occur are very, very, are intensely being examined now. And remember, this virus didn't exist in humans until November of 2019, which was only, 6 months ago? And we already know more about this virus than we know about many other diseases. So there's a lot of intensity, but a lot of it is based on previous expositions that were done with sister viruses like MERS and SARS.
How will this, though, affect your research, though? Will the American Cancer Society and like organizations doing research into cancers, will they be reaping any benefits from this COVID situation?
I wish I could see some benefits from this whole thing, to be honest with you.
I'm talking about research.
I know. There probably will be some cross-fertilization in terms of knowledge base. Certainly, one of the reasons why we've made so many advances is we've been able to take advantage of the knowledge that comes out all the time. Every day of the week, there are scientific summaries that are published. So yes, there probably will be some spinoff from the COVID research. But a lot of it is based on what was done previously with sister viruses. So there is some crossover with cancer in terms of knowledge base and approaches. especially on a genetic basis.
And of course, again, we have to go back to the American Cancer Society is funding, again, to the tune right now, $400 million is in play. And that has to come from some source. And a lot of the great fundraising events and the things that were planned had to be put on ice for right now. This is the time of the year where you would normally be having the big Relay for Life. And gosh, you're doing it now. What's the term again?
Virtually.
Virtually. I couldn't think of the virtual. Right. I was going to call it viral. But so now you're going to virtual fundraising. And now the big one is, I believe, in the middle, towards the end of April. But it will continue well beyond this broadcast. When this airs, you can go to, well, just look up the American Cancer Society on Facebook, but definitely look for Relay for Life, because you'll be able to participate from the safety of your self-isolation, that you'll be able to donate, you'll be able to support people who are participating on their teams, you'll be able to do it virtually through Facebook and through the American Cancer Society itself. They do have fundraising online at cancer.org. We are running out of time. What are your parting words for us from you, Grand Doctor, but also from the American Cancer Society?
We're there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for patients with cancer. We have a tremendous volunteer and staff that are dedicated to eradicating this disease. We will get past the COVID epidemic. We will find more cures for cancer as we go forward. But we have to remember that we have to work together, that we're all in this together, not only in the United States, but worldwide. There isn't a single human being on the face of the earth that isn't facing the same concerns and about COVID. But remember, there's 14 million people a year around the world who develop some form of cancer. One in three people in the United States will get cancer. I'm sorry, one in three women will develop cancer, and one in two men will develop cancer in their lifetime. So we will get past COVID, and with your help, we'll also get past cancer. We've made tremendous inroads in the world of cancer. We've had a 27% decline in mortality over the last 25 years, which is amazing. And we want to keep that up. So please remember American Cancer Society. Try to help us in terms of making a donation and volunteering. We need you more than ever.
And of course, you'll find opportunities to donate and to volunteer your time when you are able to at cancer.org. It will also give you access to your local chapter, but 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they are available to you at 800-227-2345. That's on their website, as well as an opportunity you can actually do a live chat with them through cancer.org. And again, virtual fundraising is happening right now. You can get all the details there. Follow them on social media. They have great events throughout the year, great information, and it's all found through their social media outlets as well as cancer.org. And my guest today, Dr. Arnold Baskies, he is the clinical professor of surgery, Rowan School of Medicine, chairman of the American Cancer Society Global Cancer Control Advisory Council, and past chair of the American Cancer Society's National Board. And Dr. Baskies, thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you so much.
Well, I look forward to speaking with you again. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.